Hi, friends, and welcome to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha, where each week we share an idea on the Parsha and how it relates to Jewish history, along with the books and articles I've read over Shabbos to learn more about it. Reminder to sign up for our weekly Substack. So many of you are slacking. ReadingJewishHistoryInTheParsha.substack.com, where you can get a write-up of our weekly class, along with all the links to the articles and books that I have discovered on my Shabbos reading journeys. Thank you so much to our sponsors and friends, Janet and Lior Hode and family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. The Jewish people finally escape Egypt. The slavery has ended, but the redemption has not yet been fully realized. After a change of heart, Paro and his army relentlessly pursue the Jewish people. The newly freed young nation is terrified as they see the formidable Egyptian army gaining on them. The Jewish people are very scared and they scream out, "Were there no graves in Egypt?" the Jewish people ask Moshe. "Why have you taken us from Egypt just to die in the desert?" In the original Pasuk, again, it's Perek Yudalad, Pasuk Yudalad, Vayomru el Moshe, Hamibli ein kivarim b'mitzrayim, lakachtanu lamus b'midbar, mazos asisalanu lahotzianu mimitzrayim. Were there no graves? What are we doing here? If we're going to be killed anyways. This is a strange reaction for a moment of crisis. The Jews surely knew there were plenty of graveyards in Egypt. So why in such a serious moment would they ask such a frustratingly rhetorical question? Are they trying out a new bit? In fact, as Rav Shamshon Rafal Hirsch explains, this is exactly what they were doing. This is, according to Rav Hirsch, the first example of Jewish humor. As Rav Hirsch explains, the sharp irony, even in the moment of extreme fear and despair, characterizes the humorous streak that is ancestral to the bright tribe of Yaakov. It is a fascinating comment, but still makes you wonder why, according to this approach, is such a monumental moment the redemption of the Jewish people interrupted with something so trivial. A moment earlier, the Jewish people were terrified and cried out, and the next moment, they're cracking jokes. Just a pasuk earlier, it says, "Vayisu v'nei Yisrael es einehem." They lifted up their eyes. "V'hine Mitzrayim nosei achareihem v'yiru me'od." They see the Egyptians running after them. They're afraid. "Vayitzaku v'nei Yisrael el Hashem." "Vayitzaku," they cried out. The next moment, they're cracking jokes. According to Rav Hirsch, and more broadly, what role does humor play in the larger story of Jewish redemption? To understand all of this, let's explore some of the history of Jewish comedy. On Easter Sunday, April 19th, 1903, a pogrom erupted in Europe. What began with broken windows and looted ended in a barbaric massacre of Jews. Almost 50 Jews were killed, including babies. The great Jewish poet Chaim Nachman Bialik was sent to Kishinev by the Jewish Historical Commission to document the attack. In 1904, following his visit, Bialik published his now classic poem in the City of Slaughter, Be'ir HaHarga. The poem was somber, even broken. As Daniel Gordas describes in his book, Israel, A Concise History of a Nation Reborn, he writes as follows: "The exile of the Jew from his own land," Bialik claims, "has more than robbed the Jew of his strength and his courage. It has eroded his capacity to feel. Exile has destroyed him." The horrors of the Kishinev pogrom played an instrumental role in creating the urgency needed for the nation Zionist movement to take off. In 1903, Herzl couched the entire Zionist movement as a reaction to these Kishinev pogroms. Herzl said, "Kishinev exists wherever Jews undergo bodily or spiritual torture, wherever their self-respect is injured and their property despoiled because they are Jews. Let us save those who can still be saved." Not everyone reacted so somberly. Salomon Rabinovich, better known by his pen name Shalom Aleichem, published his first essay 20 years before the Kishinev pogrom. In 1903, he had already developed an international reputation, though he sadly was broke for some of it after some really poor investments. The Kishinev pogrom affected Shalom Aleichem deeply. He personally organized fundraisers for the families families of the victims. As an ardent Zionist and member of Chovevei Tzion, Shalom Aleichem did not take Jewish persecution lightly. Still, his works found a way to find some semblance of humor, even amidst the horrors of Russian persecution. In Shalom Aleichem's short story, An Exchange of Letters Between America and the Old Country, written just a few years after the Kishinev pogroms, he imagines an exchange of letters between Yisroelnik in Russia and Yankel in America. The effects of the pogrom and the characteristic Jewish resilience and humor in the face of persecution. Here's a snippet of that imagined letter from Yisroelnik describing his life in Russia. Dear Yankel, you ask me to write at length and I'd like to oblige, but there's really nothing to write about. The rich are still rich and the poor are dying of hunger as they always do. What's new about that? And as far as the pogroms are concerned, thank God we have nothing to fear as we've already had ours. Two of them, in fact, and a third wouldn't be worthwhile. All of our family got through it safely, except for Lippi, who was killed with his two sons, Noach and Mordechai. First-class artisans, all three of them. Oh, yes, and except Hirsch. Peril was found dead in the cellar today with the baby at her breast. But as Getzi used to say, it might have been worse. Don't think of the better, because there's no limit to that. You ask about Heschel. He's been out of work now for a half a year. The fact is, they won't let him work in prison. Mendel did a clever thing. He just up and died. Some say of hunger, others of consumption. Personally, I think he died of both. I really don't know what else there is to write about except the cholera, which is going great. He's got like a dozen jokes in there if you read it carefully. Just the way he sets it up, saying, as far as the pogroms are concerned, thank God we have nothing more to fear as we've already had ours. Two of them, in fact. And a third wouldn't be worthwhile. You could see this is somebody who firsthand saw and experienced the horrors and had a way of imagining a discourse between the old country where they were facing the true horrors of Russian persecution and almost the naivete of Jewry in America. In 1905, after another pogrom in his hometown of Kiev, Shalom Aleichem decided to leave Russia and move to America. After moving to America, he spent a few years living in Geneva, Switzerland, but eventually moved back to the States in 1914. He died 2 years later at the age of 57. Most know Shalom Aleichem today from the Broadway musical Fiddler on the Roof, that was of course based on his short story Tevye and His Daughters. Fiddler on the Roof debuted on Broadway in 1964, almost 50 years after his death. Still, when Shalom Aleichem passed, he was an internationally renowned writer and humorist, even before Fiddler on the Roof. Famously, when Mark Twain heard that Shalom Aleichem was called the Jewish Mark Twain, he responded, "Please tell him that I am the American Shalom Aleichem." His funeral attracted over 100,000 mourners. As the New York Times reported with a huge headline, "Vast crowds honor Shalom Aleichem," police were worried that there would be a repeat of some of the riots that broke out upon the death of New York's chief rabbi, Rabbi Jacob Joseph, when he passed away in 1902. That will require a whole separate class to talk about Rabbi Jacob Joseph coming to America, being the chief rabbi, ended in total disaster. But the New York Times itself reported that the police were worried, are we going to have another Rabbi Jacob Joseph funeral? Because there were so many people there. A few hundred children followed the procession reciting Tehillim. The crowds were not just mourning a Jewish writer, but someone who captured the comedic absurdity of shtetl life, persecution, tradition, and Jewish resilience. Shalom Aleichem wrote the Yiddish epitaph on his tombstone all by himself. He reminds his readers that for all the Jewish humor he shared, he quietly still held a great deal of suffering. This is a translation of what actually appears on his tombstone, on his matseva, which of course, you know I was going to mention it, we have a picture of if you subscribe to that Substack. And special shout out to Dr. Lent, who finally, after many, many months, relented, gave in, and subscribed to that Substack. You should too. But this is what's written, again, by the hand of Shalom Aleichem on his own matseva. It's actually quite beautiful, a translation from the original Yiddish. Here lies a plain man, who wrote in plain Yiddish, and to readers he was known, a humorist, a writer. He laughed all through his life. He fought the whole world, but all the world was the gainer, and he the only loser. And while the world was merry and saw in him but gladness, poor man, he suffered on the quiet. God knows, but no one else did. That itself was published in the New York Times as a part of the story on his passing. Shalom Aleichem set up a charitable fund for struggling Jewish writers. He did not want any monuments erected in his memory, much like the words of the Talmud Yerushalmi, Ein osid nefashos letzadikim divreim hein hein zechronam. We do not erect monuments for the righteous. Their words are their legacy. And that's exactly what Shalom Aleichem said for himself. I don't want any monuments. I want people to remember and read my works, which, as his last will and testament requested, they still do every single year on his yard site. There's a great anecdote that Robin Williams once said. Robin Williams said that I was on a German talk show and the host asked me, "Why do you think there's not so much German comedy?" Robin Williams replied, "Well, did you ever think you killed all the funny people?" A few decades after the passing of Shalom Aleichem, the bounds of Jewish comedic resilience would be tested again in ways previously unimaginable. The horrors of the Holocaust, many thought, would mark the end of Jewish humor in the face of tragedy. It was simply too much. As Irving Kristol wrote in commentary in 1951, Jewish humor died with its humorous when the Nazis killed off all the Jews of Eastern Europe. Though it seems likely that even without the intervention of Hitler, this humor would not long have survived the disintegration of the ghetto community from which it drew its inspiration. He, of course, was wrong. Already in 1947, Moshe Nudelman published Gelächter der Tränen. I'm not pronouncing that correctly. I hope my Yiddish always makes you laugh. Which, of course, is translated as Laughter Through Tears, which was about comedy in post-war Poland. The title itself was a nod to Shalom Aleichem, whose writing was popularly described as allowing the Jewish people to laugh through their tears. Emanuel Ringelbaum, who's a fascinating personality who we, of course, must talk about some other week. He led the Oneg Shabbos operation that documented the conditions of the Warsaw Ghetto, record several jokes Jews would say about their horrid conditions. "We eat as if it were Yom Kippur, we sleep in sukkahs, and dress as if it were Purim," goes one joke recorded by the legendary archivist of the Warsaw Ghetto. Another line has a teacher asking a student, "What would you like to be if you were Hitler's son?" The student replies, "An orphan." Following the Holocaust, Jews channeled much of their despair into creative, oftentimes comedic endeavors. As Avi Noam Pat explains in his powerful article, Laughter Through Tears, Jewish Humor in the Aftermath of the Holocaust, Jewish humor in the DP camps was a means of regaining a sense of normalcy after the war. As was the case during the war, it also served as a coping mechanism to deal with suffering and trauma and to counter absurdities of the post-war situation. Jewish DPs were acutely aware of the intense irony of their continued existence in post-war Germany. In various ways they noted this irony, whether in casual photo of Jewish youth sitting in front of the Wannsee train station or in the appropriation of Nazi estates for kibbutz work. Some 40 farms were created for this purpose, administered by young Zionists. One of the estates had belonged to Julius Streicher, publisher of the infamous Der Stürmer, which was a Nazi newspaper, who was awaiting trial in nearby Nuremberg. The estate, this is Julius Streicher's estate, was renamed, this is so moving, Kibbutz Nili, an acronym for the biblical phrase, Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker, the eternity of the Jewish people will never be proven false. According to one of the kibbutz leaders, this is one of the greatest Jewish satisfactions, to be able to see Hebrew writings and slogans like Am Yisrael Chai, the Jewish people still live, and Netzach Yisrael Lo Yishaker, at Streicher's palace. Thus, we have named our new kibbutz the first agricultural school in Bavaria. When showing around an American visitor, one of the kibbutz members pointed out two dogs, one named Julius and the other named Streicher, explaining, "They obey and protect us. It's a pity to humiliate innocent animals with such swinish names, but we couldn't resist the temptation." Purim took a special significance in the DP camps. As my friend Yehuda Fogel once shared on social media, media from a DP camp in Landsberg, Germany, survivors made a mock grave for Haman and Hitler on Purim. And of course, I have the picture in our Substack, and you can see, Pei Nun, Po Nitman, here lies Tzorere HaYehudim. It's a matseva. It's a tombstone that has a swastika on it, and in Hebrew, talks about, here lies Tzorere HaYehudim, the person who persecuted the Jewish people, and the first name underneath it is Haman ben Hamadasa, of course, the villain of the Purim story, and underneath, in Hebrew, it says Adolf Hitler, and you could read some of the other names over there. In Buchenwald, following the war, an effigy of Hitler could be seen hanging outside of the barracks. As Avi Noam Pat concludes his article, and of course you could also read the book, which Avi Noam Pat co-edited, Humor and the Holocaust. He concludes his article that such humor served an important purpose, reminding the world and themselves that Jewish life will continue. As he writes, after the war, humor was a poignant affirmation of Mir Zainen Du, we are still here, a declaration that the Jewish people had not disappeared and indeed could at times have the last laugh. Jokes and other sayings told by Jews in ghettos and camps manifested the many functions of humor identified by survivors in a previous study. The aggression and anger of the oppressed, the self-humor that was typical of Jewish life, the dark gallows humor of those who felt death was imminent, and the humor of last resort would express the absurdity of life under such impossible circumstances. In addition, as Israel Kaplan demonstrated, humor had a critically important social function during and after the war, namely maintaining social cohesion under extreme circumstances, while also embracing the wit and resourcefulness of the oppressed and celebrating it in the aftermath of the war. Post-war humor, in the form of humorous songs, theater, jokes, literature, and art, functioned on various levels that adapted to the realities of Jewish life in liberated Germany as a means of processing the recent trauma of the war, asserting Jewish endurance in the wake of the destruction, enduring the implausible situation of continued Jewish existence in post-war Germany, confronting the hypocrisy of British policy, and uniting Jews in their laughter through tears. By this means, providing them with assurance that life would continue, even after the greatest trauma the Jewish people had ever endured. There are several theories that try to explain what makes something funny. Some have emphasized humor's ability to affirm our superiority. Laughter in this school always comes at someone else's expense, and that expense purchases a momentary feeling of supremacy. Others, most famously Sigmund Freud in his 1905 work, Jokes and Their Relation to the Unconscious, emphasize comedy's ability to provide a sense of relief for our pent-up emotions. Freud writes, if there's a situation in which, according to our usual habits, we should be tempted to release a distressing effect, and if motives then operate upon us which suppress that effect, the pleasure of humor comes about at the cost of a release of effect that does not occur. It arises from an economy at the expenditure of an effect. That didn't make so much sense to me, but that's basically what he's saying. This theory certainly has merit, but it leads to some uncomfortable and questionable conclusions about what makes us laugh. For example, does anyone who laughs at a joke in poor taste have repressed feelings or of aggression or bias? The theory that has always resonated with me is called the incongruity theory of humor. Simply stated, this theory explains that humor arises when a normal sequence is abruptly broken. For instance, a well-dressed man is not expected to slip on a banana peel. The larger the incongruity, the more potential for humor. The philosopher Schopenhauer explains it this way. Many human actions can only be performed by the help of reason and deliberation, and yet there are some which are better performed without its assistance. This very incongruity of sensuous and abstract knowledge, on account of which the latter always merely approximates the former, as mosaic approximates to painting, is the cause of a very remarkable phenomenon, which, like reason itself, is peculiar to human nature, and of which the explanations that have ever anew been attempted as insufficient. I mean laughter. And this is how he explains it. The cause of laughter in every case is simply the sudden perception of the incongruity between a concept and the real objects which have been thought through it in some relation. And laughter itself is just the expression of this incongruity. The setup for a joke establishes a sequential line of thinking. The punchline introduces the incongruity. The reason I've always found this theory so satisfying is because I think it speaks to one of the primary tools human beings use to cope with the incongruities of life. Whether the jokes are about our mothers, celebrity worship, airport tuna fish sandwiches, or parenting, comedy is commentary on the chaos of life itself. A satisfying life that unfolds sequentially is hardly grist for comedic material. Life's frustrations, disappointments, and perceived meaninglessness is what makes the comedic lens so valuable. James Fibelman, a little-known philosopher, wrote an obscure article in the Journal of Philosophy in 1938, and think about that year, where he explains what comedy seeks. Comedy, then, criticizes the finite for not being infinite. It witnesses the limitations of actuality, just as a tragedy witnesses the fragmentary exemplifications of the logical order. Tragedy affirms continuity by showing how it exists in every actual thing and event. Tragedy shows the worth of every actual down to the most ephemeral, and so is always close to the permanent value of the worshipful. Comedy comes to the same affirmation, but inversely and by indirection. Just as one might affirm beauty by criticizing the ugly, comedy catches the principle of unity in every finite thing. Great comedians are commentators. They highlight a finite world in disarray, and through comedy, a lens of meaning is superimposed onto our quotidian lives. Comedy seeks a life with meaning, and when situations and circumstances seem bereft of sense, comedy provides one. In perhaps the grandest sense, the meaningfulness which comedy seeks lies at the heart of our human experience. It is how we ultimately seek to construct our respective sense of self. Life is filled with all sorts of moments and routines that seem short of true import and significance. Comedy is one way in which we criticize the finite moments of our existence and catches the principle in unity in every finite thing. And this is why humor features so prominently in the moment of the Jewish people's redemption from Egypt. They transform their cries, Vayitzaku, into comedic quips, tzchok, which many have pointed out derive from similar etymology. The suffocating finitude of their predicament is transformed into transcendence. Even as the Egyptian pursuit bears down on them, the Jewish people retain their redemptive power to joke. Humor, indeed, is a mysterious power. It can transform even the darkest tragedies and find a glimmer of optimism. However dark the setup, the punchline creates redemptive transcendence. So thank you so much for listening to Reading Jewish History in the Parsha. To get the links to all of the articles and books mentioned, be sure to subscribe. And I know all of you are slacking to our weekly Substack, readingjewishhistoryintheparsha.substack.com. It's not scary. It just comes to your inbox. It's very easy. Thank you again to our sponsors, Jan and Lior Hoden family, with immense gratitude to Hashem. And thank you all so much for listening, and keep reading each and every Shabbos.